name is Ed Goldberg, and I'm speaking with Greg Rucka. Greg, welcome back to KABU.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Title of your latest book is Private Wars, published by Bantam. This is the second novel I've read with Tara Chase in it.
Yeah, it's the second Tara Chase novel.
Well, that might be, that might be the reason. Well, she's a secret agent in the SIS
in
England.
She's a special operations officer for the British Secret Intelligence Service. So she's... I think of her as a more realistic James Bond, in that she'll go out and kill and sleep around and drink a lot, but then, you know, she'll get a hangover and throw up afterwards.
Oh, yeah, I never saw James Bond leaning over the toilet.
Well, and we should have. So.
Yeah, we should have, yes, absolutely. We certainly should have seen him going for a medical every now and then.
I think so, and maybe the odd psyche valve, too. So.
So, well, that's one of the things I wanted to talk about. First of all, I want to remind our listeners that you've been in the graphic novel. I want to say comic books, but is that still viable?
You can call them comic books. Okay. I mean, you know, we call them graphic novels because we're afraid that people with higher degrees won't read them, you know, because there's a pejorative attached. But at the end of the day, they're comics. You know, they're panels placed in a sequence, and you read the image and you read the words, and that's what a comic book is, and it's as valid a literary form as any, I think.
I see, but that comes from a comic book writer, somebody who finds it a valid form, otherwise it wouldn't be in it in the first place.
Obviously I've got a passion for the form.
Exactly.
So.
I mean, we're not talking about Scrooge McDuck here. I mean, these are novels.
Yeah. You know, Tara comes out of a series that I do for Oni Press, which is a local publisher here in Portland, called Queen and Country. Mm-hmm. And Oni's been publishing Queen and Country for about 4, almost 5 years now.
Are all these books still available around town?
Yeah, and you should be able to find them. The occasional bookstore will have them, and just about any comic book store you go into will have what we call the trade paperbacks, which are collections of issues that comprise complete storylines. And I do think of those as novels in a form. Mm-hmm. They're similar in feel. And certainly similar in content, meaning both plot and politics, as the novels are. You know, but the biggest difference is obviously that in a novel, you can spend so much more time getting into characters and getting into their heads. Comics, one of the great things about the medium is that they allow you to play with time in a way that really very few other artistic mediums do for narrative.
Now, the other thing is they also obviate the necessity for a lot of description.
Yeah.
If she's standing in a room that's on fire, you don't have to describe that she's in a room on fire.
Well, you know, the first comic that I did, and the first one that I had published, was for Oni. It was a miniseries called Whiteout that was about a U.S. deputy marshal who was stationed at McMurdo in Antarctica. And I had thought about writing it as a novel. And I realized, it was a conscious decision. I realized there's the 1,000 words required to conjure Antarctica, or the one panel, you know, that Steve Lieber, who was the artist on that project, could draw. But I went with the panel, you know. There are clearly strengths in the medium.
Has that imposed a kind of economy on you when you're writing your novels? I mean, do you strive for an economy of words because you come from the comic book field?
Well, I think I strive for an economy of words because I'm a Hemingway fan more than anything else. You know, I mean, I look back and I look at Chandler and Hemingway and Stephen Crane as sort of, I guess, my major literary influences. So I've always been very interested in not only economy of writing, but precision of writing. I don't have anything against beautiful prose or
literary fiction.
Yeah, well, or you know, and I get leery actually of applying labels because the implication that what
I do
is not literary.
I'm with you there 100%. Yeah, but it's the generally accepted definition of literary fiction.
Yeah, I mean the best way I can look at it is, you know, I love reading James Lee Burke's work. Mm-hmm. I could never in a million years write like that. And I don't understand why he does.
Because that's the way he's from Louisiana.
And I guess
everything's a story.
Yeah, and that's the way the words come out. But mm-hmm. if I had to use that many adjectives in a sentence, I would have to shoot myself.
Was it, I think it Elmore Leonard said that when he writes a manuscript, the first thing he does is do a word search on adverbs and take all of them out?
I hadn't heard that one. The one that... the bylaw that I write by is, I believe it's a Mark Twain quote that goes, I never use policeman for a dime when I can get cop for a nickel.
And, I understand.
And I've always thought, you know, there's something to that. Yeah. There's that wonderful Thomas Jefferson line about, I'm sorry, the letter was so long, if I had had more time, I would have made it shorter.
Mm-hmm. So it's not writing, it's rewriting.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it really is. It's you know, God is always in the details when you're writing.
Yeah. And so is the devil, they say.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Let's talk a little bit about Tara Chase. Tara, when last we met, Tara Chase, and this is the last time I talked to you, was for Gentleman's Game? Was
it?
Yes.
That was the first one.
Tara winds up not in good shape at the end of that book.
No, she gets hosed. A Gentleman's Game begins with a terrorist attack in London, not unlike what happened this past July in London, which is a bombing on the underground. And the British government response is to, as you might expect, is to send their people out to kill the people they feel are responsible. And Chase is given the job of assassinating a Bin Laden-esque figure, basically the spiritual figurehead of a movement. And she ends up killing him in a mosque, along with the prince of the House of Saud, who happens to be praying with him.
In Saudi Arabia?
Actually, it's in Yemen.
Is it in Yemen?
Yeah. But,
okay. Just my fading memory.
You know, it ends up in Saud.
Oh, okay.
And from there, basically, everything goes rapidly downhill. Because she got one of the targets, but not both. She's killed one of the, you know, at that point, what, 12,000 princes of the House of Saud, which, you know, the Saudis go nuts over.
There's another 30,000.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the long and the short of it is that the British government finds themselves in a position where they're supposed to render her to the Saudis. And Chase has a very good idea of what's going to happen to her should she be so rendered, and so she bolts. And then in an attempt to sort of resolve the situation, she needs to remove the leverage that the Saudis are bringing on the Americans, and that the Americans in turn are bringing on the British to turn her in. This leads her into Saudi Arabia, and it leads her into Saudi Arabia with a colleague of hers who she is also quite in love with. And the nature of the work and the nature of Chase is such that she's not well equipped for, shall we say, emotional health. And I would argue that the people in this world that we ask to do the kinds of things that Chase does, and it is a fiction, but in all honesty, and there's a sequence in Private Wars, and I know when people read it, they're going to be like, this isn't possible. Trust me, I don't put anything in these novels that isn't possible. I research the snot out of these things.
I was going to ask you about that. Your description of tradecraft in this is quite amazing. And I was going to ask you, do you research this or you just make it all cleverly up?
Well, it's, say, about 80% research. And then when the research gives out, if you've done the research well, you have enough raw material that if you apply some logical extrapolation, you realize how it's going to have to work.
Well, this book is really dense. It not only has tradecraft for spy organizations and instruments of international politics. That's really what they are.
Yeah.
But it also has relationships between and among the Brits and the United States, their secret agencies, CIA, whoever else, you know, is doing these things, and third, fourth, fifth, sixth countries, whoever gets involved in this thing. And with all these guys, it's a dance of death. You know, they're all doing Ring Around the Rosie, and who falls down is a matter of some conjecture.
Yeah.
There's hidden agendas on many levels. I mean, this is incredible stuff.
Well, you know, I write both the comic series and the novels. Anything that's Queen and Country, I always view there are always two antagonists. There's always the organization, the guy who wants to blow up the bridge or wants to steal the information or wants the mining rights or is kidnapping the princess or whatnot. That's always one antagonist. The other antagonist is always the bureaucracy. It's always the politics, because espionage, and this is the one thing that you don't get in Bond, and it's even something that you rarely get in, certainly in early Le Carré, which is that espionage is a product of government. You do not have spies if you do not have the nation. And politics influences all of it. You don't go out to spy on, you know, Erebus unless somebody in the State Department got from somebody, you know, at the White House to hand over to somebody at the Department of Defense this job. And all of that at the end of it is, you know, well, the U.S. wants this money coming in. Well, there's always politics. And the thing about the politics is they don't care. You know, in the grand scheme of the bureaucracy, you're insignificant. The principle is maybe significant. The goal is certainly significant. But the actual, you know, the actual agent is insignificant. They're a big pen, and they're interchangeable. They don't care about Tara Chase. They care about the result.
Well, they care about Tara Chase only because she's good at it. But if they found somebody equally as good at it, she would be expendable
right.
as well.
Well, and her worth is never so great that her worth will be greater than their desire to get the goal. If to achieve their ends requires the sacrifice of that piece, they'll sacrifice the piece. Mm-hmm. Because as far as they're concerned, there are 1,000 more like her. Now, in the QNC novels and in the comic books, there's Chase and then there's her boss. There's a man named Paul Crocker.
Yeah.
And Crocker really serves as sort of the bridge and the shield between the bureaucracy and his agents, in particular, between the bureaucracy and Chase. And he struggles desperately to protect her.
On the other hand, he's not above office politics himself.
No, and he actually has to be able to play both games. One of the big plots in Private Wars is that he finally has a chance for a promotion that he wants. And ironically, the chance for that promotion comes out of him pretty much being told, I'm going to fire you in 2 weeks. So that a lot of what's motivating it isn't just that there's a situation in Uzbekistan and that the U.S. wants to do one thing and the British wants to do something else. It's also here in London, the head of SIS wants to get rid of Crocker, and Crocker doesn't want to lose his job.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's willing to take some extreme risks. And that in turn leads him to Chase, who, after a gentleman's game, has pretty much quit.
Mm-hmm. She's become a mom.
Yeah, she comes back... She comes back with her lover dead and a bun in the oven. And being Tara doesn't realize she's pregnant for about 3 months and then tries to get a leave of absence, actually goes in and argues, well, I can still do the job, and is told by Crocker there's no way.
Mm-hmm.
And the long and the short of that conversation is she quits at the start of the book and then discovers that while she may love her daughter very, very much, she hates her life. I think one of the things about Chase's pathology is that to do what she does requires, for lack of a better phrase, testing herself over and over again. Her self-worth to herself mm-hmm. is only going to be measured by how hard she can push it, what she can accomplish.
It's a peculiar form of solipsism. It basically eliminates everybody else in the universe.
Absolutely does. Because, and, you know, I've got reams and reams of paper on her background and where she comes from, but the long and the short is that she is almost incapable of accepting anybody's. She can't accept affection, but she'll take respect.
Mm-hmm.
But the way she's going to get your respect is by showing you that she's better and harder and meaner and can do the thing that nobody else can do. Well, it's interesting. You know, my wife and I were talking when I was working on the book, and there's a chapter fairly early on where she goes to visit a colleague, and she's riding the tube back to the train station afterwards, and she's looking at everybody in the car with contempt. And the contempt is because she's just like them now, and she hates it. And my wife, who's also a writer, Jennifer Van Meter, said, we have 2 kids, and she said, you know, that's something that does happen to mothers. She said, you really do hit it. It's that realization of, like, I used to be this special, vibrant person, and I did these things, and I had all these things. Now I'm a mom.
I drive just, a minivan.
Yeah, like all these other moms, I'm a mom. And it is something you have to wrestle with.
I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Greg Rucka. Your last name is spelled R-U-C-K-A, in case
yes.
you're looking for the book. Title of the book is Private Wars, and it's published by Bantam. I hope you don't find this a bit of a stretch, but I was thinking one of the few movie sequels that's better than the original is Aliens.
Yeah.
Alien was a great movie. Aliens is a much better movie. Mm. And the thing is that they gave Ripley something to love.
Yeah.
And in giving her something to love, they turned on something in her that was always there, but was not at the forefront. She was moving through life. You didn't let anything touch her, and now she's got this little girl she cares about.
Yeah,
is that? It seems to me that that's what's happening here with Tara Chase.
Yeah, I wanted Tamsin is very important.
Interesting name. Where'd you? I mean, I've seen the name before, but it's unusual.
I wanted a female version of Tom.
I got you.
Because the
not Tomasino.
No, and yeah. The father's name is Tom, and Tamsin is Welsh, I believe.
Oh, okay.
And it seemed to me, and it was just off enough that
it is.
Struck me that Chase would have named her daughter. She's not going to give her a name like, you know, Dolores or, you know, Katie.
Yeah, right.
It had to be something a little difficult. Mm-hmm. And when I found that one, I was like, well, that's perfect, because she wouldn't want to name her after the father. That's her link. You know, it's interesting because I get into trouble. The series has been going on for quite a while now. And because the nature of the series is that it really is very realistically based, follows real-world events, follows real-world politics, I trap myself into a real-world timeline, and I can already see it. I'm going to get into this problem where Chase is going to be 40 and Tamsin's going to be 16, you know, and you're going to be like, how's this going to work?
So, no, it's going to work great, because there's nothing worse than having a 16-year-old kid.
Well, I mean, there's a piece of me that wants to already get to that, but there's another piece of me that's like, I have to pace it out, otherwise I end up writing science fiction.
No, you're writing a future novel. I mean, it doesn't have to be science fiction.
Well, but I'll speculate a certain amount in advance, i.e.
craft on things like that.
Well, or, you know, a gentleman's game.
World politics.
Well, I remember waking up and turning on the radio and hearing the underground had been bombed. Mm-hmm. And the book had come out, you know, 7 months before that, which meant that I had written that sequence for myself over a year and a half before.
It just makes sense.
Well, yeah, and it's happened a lot in Q&C. I've written multiple storylines where within 6 months to a year, the events I'm writing about are either I hear that they've declassified this information that says this almost happened, or all of a sudden it's in the news. One of the second story arc in the comic book series took place in Afghanistan with, you know, the adversary being this group that nobody had heard of called the Taliban at that point. And I remember writing that because I was so furious at what the Taliban did, and in particular what they did to women. And when I write angry, I tend to write very well. I don't know why that is. But the angrier
passion.
I get...
It's passion.
The passion comes out very clearly on the page.
Sometimes passionate writing is not the best because you lose art for passion. But when you can mix the two, it usually comes out.
Well, and the danger is always you don't want to end up writing a polemic because that's going to bore the hell out of the reader. Mm-hmm. But so I try to guard myself against it. But I do tend to find that the things that piss me off are the things.
One of the things I found really clever.
I ended up with Uzbekistan.
I was just going to bring. I thought Uzbekistan was a clever choice for a lot of reasons. It's one of those friends that the United States has that we could definitely do without if they weren't in such a strategic location.
Well, we're going to have to do without them. We were being kicked out.
Mm-hmm. Well, this week.
The antigen verdicts just came down yesterday, or the day before. Yeah, it's insane. Uzbekistan is terrifying. And then there was also a piece in the news about Kazakhstan and about the, quote, president, end quote, and his iron-fisted rule. I think the story was that a critic of his administration and of him was found dead in his home, shot twice in the chest and once in the head. Mm-hmm. But they're not willing to say it was foul play yet. You know, it's like, oh. Yeah, and he had literally, like, the week
migrating
before.
Migrating birds who happen
exactly,
to be armed.
Exactly, happen to have 45s.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Uzbekistan many of the countries in Central Asia have a warlord past, and the countries are simply aggregations of competing warlords, and this is a violent, it's like a Darwinian petri dish. And what comes out of that is often not the best, but the worst.
Well, you're looking at almost universally in what, you know, what they call the Confederation of Independent States, right? The CIS.
CIS, yeah.
These are ex-Soviet bloc countries. And in Uzbekistan, I mean, Uzbekistan, as it is today, ruled by President Karimov. Karimov is an old hardline communist. He backed the attempted coup attempt, in what was it, 90?
Against Boris Yeltsin?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I can't remember the year.
Yeah,
but I mean,
it was against Yeltsin. Where, Yeltsin stood up to the tanks outside.
And he was sitting there going, yeah, take him down, take him down. And when the coup failed, he promptly turned around and said, we're independent and a democracy. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? You know, it's not that simple. And this guy is a scary piece of work. You know, the frontispiece quotes for Private Wars there are three pieces. They're all taken from things that I found this year. I mean, in 2005, all reports on human rights abuses, and in particular the use of torture and interrogation in Uzbekistan. And I think the latest one, literally, I was sending off the manuscript and sending off, I do the frontispieces last, just as they're going to the galley stage. There was a story in the New York Times. And I mean, it's like a May 22nd date on this story. This is happening right now. And this is, you know, Uzbekistan's a country that we have poured a lot of money into officially, probably a lot more money unofficially, mm-hmm. all because it is the northern crossing into Afghanistan. And also because we're very, very frightened of the Chinese getting a foothold there.
They know how to play us really well. A lot of these tin pot dictators around the world who happen to be in strategic locations have been playing us like a fiddle for a long, long time, way before the Bush administration. But the Bush administration seems, because of their worldview, seems particularly susceptible to
this. We dance so well right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, Condi was, about a month ago, she did her Central Asian tour. And she didn't go to Uzbekistan because we have been kicked out of Uzbekistan. We've been kicked out of Uzbekistan because of what happened in Andijan. And we stood up and said, you know what? That's too much. You killed like 1,000 people. We want independent inquiry. And the Uzbeki response was, bite us, pack your things, and go. So Condi hit every country in the region, right, except Uzbekistan, entirely because we've lost Uzbekistan. She's not there going, friends. Mm-hmm. She's there going, we still have bases here, right? Right? And then, oh, there was an earthquake in Pakistan. Maybe I should stop there. I mean, do you remember? Mm-hmm. That was tacked on. There was even speculation if she would stop, right? Huge, huge humanitarian crisis in Pakistan. More important to go to Tajikistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, you know, the country where this guy just got capped for saying, you know what, the president sucks, to make sure that we still have viable military assets there for a war in Afghanistan that we don't have the first idea how to manage.
I mean, she makes up for it by dragooning the Israelis into a small concession vis-a-vis the Palestinians.
Yeah, I know. So, she was up all night about that, too, I heard. Yeah.
She looked that like, too. We only have a couple minutes left, but I should like to get back into the story because when I talk to you, invariably, the politics emerges from all this because that's what the book is about, really.
Well, it's one of the reasons I like actually coming to KBU is because I don't have to worry about talking about my politics. I can say, okay, this is what it is.
The old guy, Malakoff, is about to die in Uzbekistan. He's the old tyrant.
Yeah.
He has two children. He has a daughter named Savara and a son named Ruslan.
Yeah.
And Savara, she's the emerging one here because she's the one who's more Borgian. I don't know what's Machiavellian.
Yeah, she's actually Borgia is actually pretty good. The whole book actually comes out of her. I get weird emails and weird references, and I found like 2 years ago, in a newsletter from some site, a little picture of possibly one of the most beautiful women I'd ever seen in my life. I mean, just incredibly pretty. And immaculately made up and slightly Eurasian features. One hand held to her cheek and these nails were just lacquered to perfection. Her name was Gulnara Karamova. And then I read the little article that says, this is possibly the most evil person in the world. She is apparently responsible for kidnapping Uzbeki girls, selling them into sexual slavery in the UAE, runs like all prostitution in Uzbekistan, has like her own mobile phone company, her own movie studio, three spa. I mean, it goes on and on and on. She's the daughter of the president. And I looked at this picture and I read this article and I was like, this can't be true. So I started researching it. And there wasn't a lot out there, but the stuff I found was actually even worse. And I sat back and I was like, she's a Bond villain. I mean, she really is a Bond villain. There's got to be a book here. And and that was it. I kind of looked at it and I took Uzbekistan as it stands now. And I took the idea of Gulnara and I, you know, made her almost over the top. And I think actually when you read the book, there are things you sit there and you go, okay, that's a little too much. It's like, no, that's actually less than what I've read.
Well, to me, one of the saddest images in the book, and without giving anything away here, there's a little boy named Stepan who was Ruslan's son.
Yeah.
And at the end of the book, this kid has seen so much violence, murder, evil, twistedness, that he's off in a daze. He's dissociated himself. I guess, I don't know, I don't want to say catatonia because it's not quite that bad, but it's in the low end of the catatonia spectrum.
Yeah, I think disassociative is a very good word for it. And I think one of the things that you see in Stepan and in what happens to Stepan is how the cycle is going to be perpetuated. Because I do believe that what we do to our children comes back. You know, what we teach our children, they hand down to their children.
So children are actually the symbolic emotional center of this book, aren't they?
And one of the ideas here, and it's important also to know that Crocker has a family. And one of my favorite scenes in the book.
His 16-year-old daughter?
Well, it's
going to the concert.
And one of my favorite scenes in the book is, you know, Crocker is an absolute tyrant in the office and in the ops room, and his word is law. And there's a scene in the book where he's making breakfast for his wife and his two daughters. He's got a 16-year-old and like a 13-year-old. And he's got no authority in that house at all. He lays down the rules, and they laugh at him, and they ignore him, and...
He says, I have no power in my own home.
Yeah, and that was very important to me because it isn't that he needs that power. It's that this is the healthier relationship. And one of the things that separates Crocker from Chase is that Crocker has found a way to live. He can be what he needs to be in the office, and he can carry those burdens. But he can still come home, and he can still love his family and be loved by them. We have to
wind this up. I'm sorry. I've been speaking with Greg Rucka. Greg is the author of Private Wars, published by Bantam. Greg, what are you working on these days?
I'm working on the new Kodiak novel. It's called Patriot Acts. Should be out next year.
Okay. Thanks very much for coming.
Thank you.
I'm Carlos Chavez, host of a new radio program called Chicanismo that examines the unique cultural movement and struggle of the Mexican-American or Chicano.
The program focuses on the history of the Chicano that is absent from the public school's cultural studies and on the artistic contributions of Chicano musicians, poets, muralists, and more.
Tune in to the program's pilot this Thursday, February 16th at 10 a.m.
We have a ticket giveaway for Al Franken, who will be at the Schnitzer Concert Hall on February 17th at 8 p.m. You must not have won anything from KABU within the last 30 days, and you must be able to pick up the tickets at the station sometime between 9 a.m. and 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. We have one pair of tickets to give away. To win, be the first caller to phone 503-231-8032. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Stay tuned at 10:30 for Stage and Studio. D-May Roberts presents a Valentine's Day special. At 11, it's Democracy Now!